Welcome to the Midweek Drive.
Thank you very much for having me again. I'm perfect, having a great day. It's been very, very warm, but it's decreased slightly, so I'm in my jacket now. I'm fine, thank you.
20 degrees centigrade. Yeah. That's very warm for people in England, at least. Whether that's very warm for people in Scotland, I don't know. William Coles, is that very warm if you're actually north of Hadrian's Wall?
That would be Midsummer's Day, 20 degrees in Scotland. At the moment, as usual, it's cloudy and it's nowhere close to 20 degrees.
Never mind. Maybe in Wales, you know, we've got our Scottish representative. Maybe we can actually go to Wales and find out. Robin Pearce, is that warm in Wales, 20 degrees centigrade, or is it just a case of no?
It's not too bad, but according to the thermometer I have on my wall, which is connected to a sensor outside the house, we got you guys beat. It's 22.
Wow.
It sure doesn't feel like it, though.
Well, you say that, but in North Carolina, I was almost choking with the emotion there. North Carolina. Jessica, what's the temperature there before, of course, you head out for another day's work with the ducks? Is it working with the ducks again?
We did that yesterday, yeah, and it is baby season at the farm, so there were goslings all over the place. It was so cute.
There's nothing more wonderful than working with ducks. This is one of the reasons why I thought that news story about penguins that actually have, you know, stuffed toys, that's not the same.
No.
You need genuine ducks to actually keep you happy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, you know, William, can you imagine sort of having a world where you've got fake penguins guiding other penguins? Surely you want real avian friends. Or is it just a case
of... perhaps even puppets.
Puppies.
Little glass puppets.
Oh, puppets. Puppets, right. See, ahead of the game, though, I thought we were going to actually comment already on our behavioural specialists, Lorna Winters and Carolyn Menteith, who obviously got key things to say about canines and so on. Did you realise, Kaylee, that there are many people who actually, if they're upset with their canine friend, a puppy that they might have purchased, if that puppy hasn't actually been fully toilet trained within 6 months, it gets the boot?
Yeah. Really? Why?
Because they feel as though it's an antisocial puppy.
Oh, dear.
They can't cope with respect to the puppy. The puppy is causing problems.
Oh, no.
Therefore, they're sending it on its way. I mean, Jessica, is that something that impacts yourself? I mean, is it a case of, you know, if the puppy doesn't behave in the first 6 months, then frankly, it's got to go?
No, of course not. I think when you take on the animal, you know, you're taking on that responsibility. And I don't have a dog, but we do have a cat. And, you know, when they're very young, they love to scratch everything. Mm. But I think it's a matter of learning to train them, because that's their instinct. They're going to do what's their instinct. And it's up to their human to help them.
So far, it's looking good. William, from your own point of view, is it a case of, no, if you don't actually cut the mustard fairly rapidly, you're on your way?
Well, I think it's a great idea. If only we could let the puppies know they've got this sort of six-month deadline, because most of them just suddenly think, why am I being shipped out? But what we should try and do is, it's great for boyfriends and girlfriends. Mm. You say, look, you've got 6 months to improve your manners, your table manners, or whatever it is that's causing a problem. And if you continue to pee in the toilet with this and leave the seat up, then you're out. Mm.
This could be a useful thing. However, it'll lead to more commentary from Jessica, from William, and probably Robin as well, who gets a little name check in this little piece when we speak to Lorna Winters and Carolyn Menteith. And the first question I actually put to both Lorna and Carolyn is there such a thing as normal when it comes to dogs?
Yes, I think, you know, if you think about it as raising a child, there are some things that are fairly normal. You have to, you know, toilet train, you have to teach them how to walk, you have to, you know, teach them to go to school, read and write. So it's a similar thing with puppies. There are some very normal developmental things that they're going to go through, like sleep training, toilet training, etc. So yeah, there are some normalities.
And again, different breeds, different scenarios. I mean, is that something else, Carolyn, that also impacts, that you can't expect a Chihuahua to actually have the same needs and basic sort of growth spurts as an Alsatian, for instance?
No, absolutely. I mean, every single dog is an individual, and there's all kinds of reasons why they're individuals. And breed and what we originally wanted them to do makes a really, really big part of that. So when you ask, is your dog normal? What's normal for a Chihuahua? What's normal for a Labrador? Who's just going to carry your slippers around all the time? What's normal for a Cocker Spaniel who scent out everything? Is entirely different. And so owners have to look at their dogs as a complete individual, just as they do their children.
Now, this is research that came across, of course, from puppy training app Zigzag, and it does actually reveal a fairly wide knowledge gap when it comes to that whole question of what is normal behavior and development. I mean, were you surprised at all, Lorna, by the notion that over a quarter of dog owners would consider giving up their puppy if they displayed behavior that was mistakenly identified as problematic?
Not surprised. I think based on the kind of questions we're getting from these puppy owners every day through our support team, and obviously working in the industry for the last 10 or 15 years, I've seen that change over time in terms of, I suppose, a change of expectations that people now have of their puppies, which maybe wasn't there about 15 years ago.
I mean, 2/3 of British folk apparently think raising a puppy is comparable to raising a child. Well, yeah, we've been talking about this for years. It's a big responsibility. You don't just go on impulse, actually say, oh, I'll just take a child, or I'll just have a puppy, etc., or both. But is the message that Zigzag is obviously putting through here actually going to actually reach the important thing? So we don't. I mean, ultimately, the worst thing that can happen is to basically say, right, that's it. I'm sorry, I've had enough. You're out. We're not going to spend any more time with you. You are no longer part of this household. Go away, puppy.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think that's one of the things that Zigzag is going to address and is addressing. It's extraordinary, the research that's come out, that half of the people think that a puppy toileting, so peeing or pooing in the carpet under 12 weeks old is a behaviour problem. Yeah, exactly the same people will expect their children not to start sleep toilet training until they're 2 or 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And so it's education. I think that's what Zigzag's trying to get out. And it's trying to do it in a fun way. It's about reminding people that, yes, puppies are hard work, but they're a lot of fun as well if you're prepared for the reality, for the sleepless nights, and for the educating them in the same way that you would a child.
And barking being identified as a problem, yes, I can kind of understand that, but that also, it's down to choice, isn't it, Lorna? Because surely there are more dog breeds that are more prone to actually bark than others in terms of the approach.
Yes, I mean, there are some breeds that are more prone to it, but also I think we need to recognise and remember that it's just one of the ways that dogs try to communicate with us. And they're not barking just because they want to be a pain in our backside. They're barking because they're trying to tell us something. And it's our job to therefore, you know, understand our dogs a lot better than we are today. You know, watch their body language, work with them closely, play with them, so we can start to understand what it is they're needing that can prevent the barking in the first place. Sometimes you just get excited barking. That's very normal behavior for dogs. It's how they communicate. And that's fine and that's acceptable. It's the incessant barking that can sometimes be the problem.
Yeah, Lorna, with over 30 years of the teaching profession, you get used to excited barking with human beings as well. So it is, that's a classic line. I mean, Carolyn, I've talked about breeds, obviously, but what about crossbreeds, mongrels, rescue dogs, and so on and so forth? Is it the same thing from that point of view? You need to actually engage in some canine communication to understand what they're about.
Well, very much. I mean, we as humans are a verbal species, so we talk to each other and we tell each other what's going on. Dogs are also really communicative, but they do it differently. They do it through body language. Sometimes it's really subtle to us. So a dog that's maybe licking their lips or yawning might be uncomfortable or might be worried. And it's about learning to speak dog. And that goes across the board, whether they're rescue dogs, whether they're crossbreeds, whatever they are. It's about recognizing them as an individual. And one of the great things that Zigzag does is it's not just about obedience training. It's not about teaching your dog to sit and come and walk nicely on a lead. It's about building a relationship and about building a bond. And that's what keeps people together.
And Lorna, in terms of that canine communication that we talk about, is it a case of, I mean, you're probably both too young to remember Barbara Woodhouse and her immortal word, sit, and so
we
on.
We do remember Barbara.
Well, there we go. Who would have thought it? I thought I was sort of one of those dying breed who actually sort of said, "Ah, sit." But that whole approach, which at the time seemed revolutionary in I think the 1970s or thereabouts, Have we gone on from the, are we closer to, in the classic words of Dr. Doolittle, being able to talk with our animal friends, and particularly canines?
Yes, we certainly are. We've learned a lot in the last 30 years. We've done a lot of research. There's a lot of science now that's been proven to show, dogs are sentient beings. They have emotions, they have feelings. Every dog is different. So it's really important that you work together as a team. You teach them, you coach them, you listen, you watch, and most importantly, play and have fun with them. That's the best way that you're going to start to build a relationship that's based on trust. And that's the most important thing. You need to have a relationship with your dog that's based on trust. They want to work with you. They want to have fun with you. They want to do things with you. And that makes it so much easier. And also, it's just more fun for everybody.
And Carolyn, we know from obviously many movies that all dogs go to heaven. But is there also a tendency to sometimes anthropomorphize, to actually say, OK, we can relate to you because we're both carbon based life forms. But actually, there are more than just subtle differences. There are differences in terms of the way in which dogs, traditionally, of course, pack animals, actually genetically will respond to their pack leaders or humans.
There's no doubt that dogs and humans are completely different, and we can't look at our dogs as being little humans in fur coats. They do share the same emotions as we do, the same feelings as we do, and they behave because of the way they feel in exactly the same way as we do. But obviously they do lots of things that we don't. They enjoy digging, and they enjoy barking, and they enjoy bringing things back, and they enjoy working with you. And so it's about recognizing where the similarities are, but also recognizing what makes dogs dogs. Because if you expect them to be humans, then you're going to be disappointed. So it's recognizing the dogginess of dogs and really enjoying that, and spending time finding out what doggy things your dog really likes doing and how you can share those. And that's one of the things that Zigzag does really well. And that's why I've been really pleased to work alongside Zigzag, is because it really looks at every single dog and owner combination as utterly unique and creates a purpose personalized program exactly for them, which nothing else does.
I'm just impressed, actually, for the benefit of our listener, Lorna, on Zoom, her canine friends just actually went over to the background, put in a canine cameo appearance there, which is wonderful. And I do know that obviously our very regular correspondent and indeed critic Robin Pierce has great fondness for his, I think, 11-year-old dog Bo, basically, and very much connects on that basis. So it is a case of differences do work through the whole thing, and that's a delight. So Lorna, where can people find out details about Zigzag and this particular training program, this app, that can actually help us to understand our puppies even better?
Yeah, you can find Zigzag in the app stores, whether Google or Apple app stores. And you can also find more details on our website, which is zigzag.dog.
Dog behaviourists and trainers Carolyn Menteith and Lorna Winter, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. And to any canines who may be listening, I suppose, woof, woof.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
So dogs are not little humans in fur coats. I know, Kaylee, it's a shocking revelation.
It really is.
But, so it goes. I mean, Jessica, dogs not little humans in fur coats. I mean, if ever they said breaking news is about to launch the planet, that's got to be critical. Any thoughts on what you've just heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's completely true. I think that it's strange that people kind of take in an animal and then expect it to completely not act like an animal, and yet we understand that children often need this period to learn. There's a problem where a lot of duckling for Easter and then for their kids, and then they realize that baby ducks actually turn into ducks and they can't handle having that animal. So I think it's really important, like you were saying, to understand your limits and what you're going to have to do when you do adopt an animal, because you're going to be responsible for its little life and behavior for many years.
Precisely. We obviously say happy birthday, Bo, because it was her birthday recently. So
happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday, Bo. There you are. The message is actually going well. We'll find out, obviously, what Bo's companion is going to say in a few moments. But William Coles, you've heard that there. Can you still apply dog behavioral psychology to boyfriends?
Well, we hope so. But by the way, congratulations on using the biggest word that I have ever heard used on Siren. Anthropomorphize. I mean, it's a big one. Do most people actually know what it means?
Let's just test it. Kaylee, anthropomorphized?
Can you use it in a sentence? Can you give it some context?
Disney often anthropomorphizes their character.
Is it
I wish we'd never started it. I mean,
let's forget about the question.
Yeah, exactly. You're quite right. Keep it simple, William. All the important things that are actually there. Anyway, carry on.
Right. Okay. My second question is: what is the difference between a crossbreed and a mongrel? Are they the same thing? And you know, 30 years ago we called them mongrels, and now classier we call them labradoodles and crossbreeds.
Mm. That's something I must chase up with both Lorna and Carolyn in the fullness of time, of course. And where that sits with respect to ducks, who knows? But you know, that's just a by-the-by thing. Kaylee,
mm-hmm.
Do you have a dog?
No, I did for 8 years. I had a Labrador called Poppy. She was the best, but she passed away at the start of COVID. So it's been a few years now, but maybe my parents will get another one, and I'm very excited if they
and
do.
And whilst we're talking about your parents, let's not forget, of course, your father, who is doing mega successful
things.
He's
had enough promotion.
In terms of the website, of course, that he runs on YouTube is?
Mm-hmm. Yes. John Builds Iconic Military Models.
John Builds.
Yeah, it's his birthday
iconic
soon.
Iconic Military Models.
I'll be buying him a model soon, and he will be...
Will it be an iconic military model?
I assume so. I think that's his standard of models. I don't think anything else will pass his standardisation.
Well, it's very important.
Yeah.
Robin, let's turn to your good self and Beau. Is Beau sitting by your side as we speak, or is it a case of, no, we've had an argument, she's turned 11, she's doing her own thing these days?
Well, we have not had an argument, but she is in the kitchen wolfing down her food right now.
Oh, she's a crossbreed between a wolf and a dog, then.
Well, that was an interesting pre-record you did. I mean, dogs aren't little humans in fur coats.
Mm.
I think that's an important one, as well as, I mean, as you said, people anthropomorphize animals, they take them to be little kids, but this doesn't take away from something that I've said on the show many times. You have to raise a dog, a puppy, as much as you would raise a child. Mm-hmm. And you've got to get to know them. They've got, I mean, apart from different breeds having different needs, They have their own individual idiosyncrasies. There's a big word for you, William, and all the way from Wales. And they have quirks.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had a dog, William? Or have you been a little boy without any dogs at all? Apart from, obviously, the hound dogs of reporting that you've obviously got associated with over the years.
My dad was a farmer. And we had a ton of dogs and cats and peacocks and guinea fowl. And geese as well. So yeah, but currently my wife unfortunately is dog phobic, and so we have, since I got married, we have not had a dog. We've got two goldfish though, if that's any use.
Yeah, as long as you remember that goldfish are not tiny human beings in little swimsuits,
mm-hmm.
because that's also important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean they could be. And let's face it, as we turn to Jessica once again, we simply have to say. You see, that's attitude, the Mighty Ducks theme. Here come the Mighty Ducks. I think you should actually switch up your tour duck routine and give the ducks the attitude that the television show, which you're probably totally unfamiliar with, Mighty Ducks, actually benefited from.
I should, and I've never heard of that show ever.
Yeah. Let's just do a round robin. Mighty Ducks?
No.
I mean, it does go on to actually follow in with another chorus. You get the sense of Mighty Ducks that's coming across there. Very important. Robin, Mighty Ducks, I don't seem to recall it being featured in Starburst. Maybe it's one we can look to.
No, I think I might have ducked out of that one.
Yeah, okay. Structure, the rehearsal, it's all there. William, the importance of children's literature. We haven't got Sarah Bullimore with us because she's still busily putting together the New York Book Festival. The brochures are now officially out there. Is children's literature still vitally important, or is it a case of I don't know. Maybe it's all young adults these days. And frankly, the notion of actually going to see children's literature routines at the New York Book Festival, in which you can look at a whole variety of things such as George the Dragon, author in Craftstone, The Faraway Tree, etc. It's so 20th century.
Children's literature is vital. That's where we get our books in. I mean, it's a real craft. I've had a stab at a few children's books and they're writing them, and they're not easy to do. And everyone thinks they can have a pop. But yeah, this is where, of course, some people may get into reading books later on if they haven't read much as kids. But what you're hoping for is that children come to enjoy books in their own right.
Quite right. And Indiana Bones and the Lost Library. So I did the Bones, Dogs, Indiana Bones and the Lost Library, taking place on Sunday, the 10th of July, in which you can join author Harry Heap as he reads from his fantastic book, Indiana Bones and the Lost Library. Indiana Bones back for a second dog-tastic detective escapade. Once again, he and his bestest friend, Aisha, have to gather their wits, courage and plenty of snacks to sniff out clues and solve a twisty mystery. On the hunt for the Avengers' lost treasure, the intrepid travellers set off on another trek. But nothing is ever simple for our heroes, and the Slippery Serpent and Stinky Ringo are still hot on their tails, determined to thwart their every move. Robin, I think you're just beyond this because it's recommended for ages 6 to 9, but Indiana Bones of the Lost Library could be a perfect way of spending a Sunday between 11 a.m. and 12 noon at the National Civil War Centre, a couple of days after I actually host a piece with Adrian Tchaikovsky. So there you go.
Well, it's one to bear in mind, isn't it? I mean, Indiana, but I love the pun. I just love the pun.
Yeah. Yeah. Jessica, are you still able to stick with us for another half hour as we go into the joys of John West? Once again, John West Media, author, historian and presenter.
I would absolutely love to.
Marvellous. William, I mean, you normally go at this time, but you're more than welcome to stay. I did send you the other link. It's entirely up to your good self. Lots of things happen in Edinburgh. I can appreciate other things.
I've got a scarper. I've got kiddie maintenance duties. I've got to take him off to a thing called tap dancing.
Wow. Do you not find that they can slip into the sink if they're not really if they're not really careful with the taps? I mean, it depends on the plumber, surely, how you're actually coordinating that.
Is that a Les Dawson joke?
Hey, quick one there. Jessica, no idea who Les Dawson was. No. Kaylee,
no,
shaking her head.
You already know my answer.
Absolutely. Cultural reference, zero. And Robin probably could just go there, but no, I don't think so. So that means, Kaylee, mm-hmm. It's only your second show, and yeah. Let's face it, you have to thank John Bill's Iconic Military Models for actually representing the whole thing here. What are the last two questions we need to put to William Coles?
Have you had a wonderful time here today, William?
It's been fantastic. Fantastic. I've learned so much. I've learned new words, and I've learned about dogs. It's been great. And I've learned how to deal with prospective girlfriends and boyfriends.
Yeah, quite fundamental aspects of life, yeah. and will you be joining us again?
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we leave you with a rhetorical question which Jessica and Robin can consider, and possibly you too, dear listener, courtesy of the Baha Man.
Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out?
The party was nice, the party was bumping. And everybody having a ball. Until the fellas started in calling. And the girls respond to the call. I heard a boom and shout out.
Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out?
I see the dance. Billy Bongers, get out. Get back, Gruffy. Bash, Gruffy. Get back, you flea infested mongrel. Gonna tell myself I'm man, no get angry.
Hey, yeah. V-I-O.
Two Eddie cows calling them canine. Hey,
V-I-O.
But they tell me, hey, man, start up the party.
V-I-O.
You put a woman in front and a man behind. I have a woman shout out.
Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out?
is nothing if he don't have a foot.
Hold on, doggy, hold your foot. Hold on, doggy, hold it.
Bus Gruffy, get back, you flee, invest in mongrel.
Well, if I am a dog, the party is on. I gotta get my groove on, got my mind, I'm gone. Do you see the rays coming from my eye? Walking to the place, the Digimon is breaking them down. Me and my white socks, short, dealing, gancy color. Any caliber, do I think I knew, that's why they call me Pitbull. Cause I'm the man of the land, when it's to me, they say, ooh.
Who let the dogs out?
I don't know, do you? Many a year since we last played the Baha Man and Who Let the Dogs Out, and it'll probably be a few years before we actually play it again. We welcome to the Midweek Drive now an awesome author extraordinaire. Funny enough, we were talking about children's literature. Set the scene, of course, in many ways. And though he's not appearing at this year's Newark Book Festival, it's always next year, we're delighted to welcome the awesomeness that is Robert Paul Weston to the programme. How are you, Robert? Welcome back to the Midweek Drive.
I'm very well. Can you hear me?
Of course we can hear you. We
good,
can hear
all right.
Because you're shouting. Because I will reveal to the listener that Robert is currently about, I'd say 350 yards, imperial measurements, 350 yards away from the Siren Studio here at the University of Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Physically, he could actually step out of his office, turn left, turn right,
so
go down the stairs.
It would be good if my hand could sort of, there's a special effect.
It is a special effect
that is missing.
Here it's
right
here,
now.
It's here, it's here, I've done it.
And then he'd be with us, actually here. He could take up that chair right next to you, Kaylee, and that'd be physically
in the studio. Please?
I'm one floor up.
One floor up, exactly. One floor up in the whole system. I mean, it's the sort of thing that our ace producer, historian, presenter, John West, might say, for goodness sakes, those Canadians, they come over here and just getting them to go one floor downstairs, it's too much. How are you, John?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Well, all okay, all things considered. And we also have, of course, Robin Pierce back from Wales. As you said, Kaylee, I wasn't referring to Robin when I said, just come on down, Robin. You know, you literally just fly over, get in the jet.
I thought, how far are his jokes going, Robin? I thought, really?
It's too much. Let's talk a little bit about Robert and your backdrop, because we're going to go to Britain's haunted heritage and a whole heap of other goodies as well. But this particular aspect of robertpaulweston.com, and you've got a lot of famous material. I mean, I literally share an office next to an awesome writer, an award-winning children's writer in so many ways. Robert, share with us what's some of the things that people may have actually connected with you.
I didn't realize it was going to be about me. I thought I was guesting and chatting and
did that on your first year, Robert. You know, you're ready now to actually work through that. He's now turning to his library, to his bookcase.
I've got them down on the bottom shelf.
Yeah.
I guess the thing that if I'm known for anything, it's this book, Zorgamazoo. Mm. It is a novel about a little under 300 pages, but it is a little bit different from most novels in that it is not written in prose. It is written entirely in verse, and a very particular kind of verse. It is basically, if you can imagine the plot of a Roald Dahl novel that was given to Dr. Seuss. And that's about it.
Wow.
So it's all written in rhyming anapestic tetrameter. So yeah, the easiest way to explain it is just to read you just the opening page. It goes like this. It begins, "Here is a story that's stranger than strange. Before you begin, you may want to arrange a blanket, a cushion, a comfortable seat, and maybe some cocoa and something to eat. I'll warn you, of course, before we commence, my story is eerie and full of suspense, brimming with danger and narrow escapes and creatures of many remarkable shapes, etc. for a long
way."
Wow.
I'm gonna come upstairs and steal
yeah. that. yeah, it's a bit of a labor-intensive way to tell a story. I've done that twice. I've done it with another book called Prince Pugly of Spud in the Kingdom of Spiff. And then my
you
other
never told me you wrote about Boris Johnson's early childhood. A bit of a shocker there. So, Prince Pudley of Spudley.
I can kind of see it, yeah.
Yeah, Zorgamazoo, the classic internationally award-winning novel in verse that continues to astonish readers around the world. A brave young girl, an eccentric underground creature, a secret map, a bizarre lottery, an alien invasion, a sport that brings together the finer points of cricket, swimming, and chess. Zorgamazoo is about all this and more. Also, it rhymes. John, how long is it before you actually say the world needs to have a documentary made about Zorgamazoo?
Oh, yeah, immediately, I think. Hopefully Jason Figgis can make it. The director, is he on? Did he get through?
He might be joining us after 6 o'clock. There's only so much goodness we can actually have, John. So, you know, hopefully he'll join us in our third Zoom feature. But we'll keep an eye out on that. Jessica, I know you're a keen children's writing aficionado, etc. And you'll actually be heading over to Trinity College Dublin to actually do postgraduate studies with respect to that in the not-too-distant future. But any thoughts for Robert, any questions for Robert about Zorgamazoo, Sakura's Cherry Blossoms, Natsumi's Song of Summer, Prince Pugly of Spud, we've already heard about that, don't go the Boris Johnson route, or indeed other fine folk?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I've actually heard of Zorgamazoo, so it's very cool to get to speak to you, and I'd love to know where you get your inspiration from.
Inspiration, I mean, I guess the short answer is if I knew, I would be running the world. I think it's pretty, inspiration's pretty slippery, mercurial kind of thing. I think you just, yes and no. That's everything I've just said is true. And yet I do think that probably the place that I get the most inspiration is usually from reading other books or even newspapers, journalism, you know, true stories. Basically, when I'm reading and I'm in that zone of the story, the story zone, sometimes you just think, oh, that surprised me. The I would have turned left instead of right at that corner, and then that left direction spins out into, oh, well, what if you know, characters did that? How would that play out? And suddenly, slowly, something will develop. That may be a premise for something new. So there is that, but there's no way to control when that happens. So I think where it comes from, you just have to put yourself in harm's way and just read a lot and be open and ready when inspiration comes knocking.
Is there like a place that you like to go to write? I know some people like to, you know, be alone or go to a cafe. Is there somewhere you like to be?
Is there somewhere I like to be? I guess lately, or like as I've progressed, I used to write in cafes. I do like a little bit of background noise, a little bit of life, just because writing is pretty lonely. So I do like to write in public spaces, but I realized over time the most efficient public space is probably the library. So I do write in libraries. A private carol with a little bit of life, but it's silent and conducive to long periods of concentration. So yeah, it's pretty kind of dull, really, but yeah, a library.
Is it true that originally, Robert, you were born in England and then went over to Canada as a child?
Yes, it is. I was born in Dover, on the south coast of Kent there. My father used to be an immigration officer at Dover Calais in the 70s. Mm. And so I've just dated myself, there you go. And I through a series of I unfortunate events? Not really, but...
No, that's Lemony Snicket. That's already copyrighted. Yeah, you can't do it down that route, yeah. You know? Let's be honest.
So, well, I got to, you know, I got to spread the love, you know. So, yeah, we moved to Canada when I was very young, and so I grew up to become ethnically Canadian, I guess, which to some may sound like an oxymoron. I don't know, depending on your opinion about... Yeah.
Listen, surely, Robert, it's a boot. It's not a bat, it's a boot. If you're a genuine Canadian, you'll actually break into a boot, will you not?
Yeah, I don't know who says that. I don't know who.
Mike Myers says it regularly.
Specific, like, there's, you know, rural Canadians may slightly do something like that.
It could be a cliche.
Know. I think this is the rest of the world having a tin ear for Canadian accents.
Yeah, well, frankly. You know, tin ear, ten city, it's all very confusing. Robert, somebody who can obviously express the best aspects of Welsh literature and so on, any questions you'd like to put to the man who will not come downstairs into the Siren Studio? Sorry, Robert. I mean, you know, we're literally, I mean, his office is just around the corner.
If I had known this was happening,
it's ridiculous, to be honest.
I would have come. I mean, I was, in my defense, I was sent a Zoom link.
This is true.
So
yeah.
It does. There are some.
And I hadn't anticipated that people will be out doing various other things. Anyway, I was trying to actually locate him earlier today, but I thought he's not in. He's anyway, Robert. Robin.
Robert. I'd just like to point out, as a long, long time sufferer, don't go to the studio because he will actually mercilessly mock you about your accent because he does it to me all the time.
That's outrageous. What an outrageous slur, Taffy, honestly.
And
goodness
everybody
sake.
Knows it because you can just listen to any of the shows we've done together. Something will come out about my locality, my nationality, or my accent every time.
Look, I mean, if I can't do that as an Irish, Polish, English person, what can you say? You know? Please.
See, I can't do it back because I'm spoiled for choice. Right. Now
oh,
then.
I see. okay, I mean, there is precedent for this. I mean, obviously you have acoustic evidence of this. And as we've just heard, I got the old aboot just now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the evidence is clear. Alex is wearing this on his sleeve.
He has even asked me if I understand words that are being said on the show.
Yeah, but sometimes you have cultural differences. You cross the border into Wales, who knows what could happen?
I too am a published writer. I write in English. What a surprise.
It sounds like I dodged a bullet. It sounds like this is a safe haven. I'm going to stay here, please.
I do have a question and an observation, which can also be a question.
Okay.
My first one is, what inspired you to write Zorgamazoo in verse? Because... as you said, that seems very, very labor intensive.
Yeah.
And if I was going to write something and I found that I had to do it in verse, unless it was a dirty limerick, I would just give up after five lines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess there is the answer to this question, which is naivete and ignorance of poetic form. That I just didn't know what I was getting into. And
are you saying, Robert, that Robin's much vaunted, there was a young gentleman from Venus who spent many times with his, is actually not, you know, that's not acceptable.
Yeah, that's not going to make it into my children's
book. No, good. Good to hear. Yeah.
Darn.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean... I had an idea for a story, and I genuinely did not, it generally got out of hand that I started writing. I thought I was writing a kind of a long picture book when I started. And so the form I thought, I had an idea that I quite liked about mythical creatures of Earth going vanishing, and which was something I felt I had experienced when I was a kid. You could open newspapers and see like strange lights seen over Lincoln, and slowly you would these strange stories would disappear from the news. And this was a kind of this book is a kind of explanation of what happened. You know, maybe they were kidnapped. Why? Who would do this? And so I had this idea and I thought I can tell this in about maybe 4 or 5 chapters. It'll be a long picture book. Some of Dr. Seuss's books are a little bit long and I really like the form. And I remembered loving it when I was a kid and wanting a book like that again. And by the time I realized this was a much bigger story, I was too far into it and I would never get that time back. And I just had to power through it just out of sheer, you know, so that I would have a return on investment, basically.
And fundamentally, Robert, it led to your scholarship at the University of Lincoln, where students can actually gaze in wonderment as they look up at you from their position on the floor saying, I wish I could write Robert Paul Weston.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely accurate. Oh. I don't know about that. I don't know.
I
about
mean,
this,
not like, from what I've heard from Kaylee. She was
looking up. I don't know about that. Yeah. But there's another reason for this as well, though. Some of my background is in linguistics, and there's an area of linguistics called cognitive linguistics, like looking at what happens in the brain when you learn languages and when you acquire new languages. And there's a branch of literature which is cognitive poetics, which is looking at what happens in the brain while you read, write, or listen to poetry. And there is some evidence that it's very, you know, it's shaky evidence because it's difficult to cut open the brain while you're listening to poetry without killing the poet or the listener. But there is a
sometimes I feel you're too conservative in these approaches to your ethical research, Robert. I mean, you know.
All right, you know what? I'll leave that to a collaboration between Alex and the medical
school. Exactly. You know, it's a cross collaborative exercise. Why shouldn't we? Then we can actually give a whole new world to be explored by the wonders of John West Media. I'm just saying, it could work out there.
Yeah. One thing I would like to ask or point out. Cause this is baffling me, right? I mean, I will be frank, and you know. Rob, I've never heard of your work before because I am too old to be, you know, of your audience. Yeah. I'm potentially the oldest person on this panel. But what I really can't understand is how come J.K. Rowling made it bigger than you and yours sounds so much more stylish, so much more fun and so much more entertaining? Because that woman surely is overrated. Anybody listening to this want to argue with me?
First I'd like to say I like this question. This is a good question. And it's mysterious to me. I don't know why I don't live in a castle in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
I've never understood. I have no answer. I do think, you know, this book is Zorgamazoo. It is pretty unique. So there's just the simple aspect that it is in some ways, although it sounds traditional, there's an element of experimentation to this, right? Because nobody writes this much of it, this much rhyming anapestic tetrameter all at once. So there's a bit of experimentation, which means you're going to cut out. So I do think, but I do think J.K. Rowling is very good on plot. I think she is a gifted plotter. The Harry Potter books are very well plotted books. And I don't think I don't think that's up for debate. I think they're demonstrably well plotted books. And I do think that if you were to say to compare a book that is very well plotted, meaning plot being a traditional, you know, pillar of storytelling, versus told in a sort of a rather intricate, wordy, slightly experimental, slightly, you know, off form. I think I can see why plot is more popular. than experimentation with form.
In the immortal words,
there you go. That's my answer. That's what that's all I got. That's my best answer.
In the immortal words of Tegan, Queen Anne Books in Seattle, if you can imagine the spawn of the Harry Potter series and Dr. Seuss's "There's a Wocket in My Pocket," I thought he was just pleased to see me. No, that's not the whole title. You are on the right track to understanding the magical, hilarious, whiz-bang creativity of Zorgamazoo. John West, any questions you'd like to put before we start talking about Cromwell and the English Civil War with our ace Canadian author, born in Dover, of course? That's Robert Paul Weston.
I know Dover really well. It was quite a haunted place, actually. So what's your next project then?
My next project? I have recently finished a sequel to Zorgamazoo. Oh. So, that is finished. I realize now that no one knows about the, Alec, you have just got a scoop on that. I mean, or at least.
You see, that's what happens, Kaylee. You sort of lull them into a false sense of security, and suddenly it's a case of, take that, Times review of books, you know, as Zorgamazoo part two.
There is a sequel. I mean, it's a long time coming. It has taken me many years. It is bigger than, it's significantly bigger than Zorgamazoo.
Bigger than 283 pages.
Yeah, it's significantly bigger than
that.
So it is a bit of an unwieldy tome. I don't know what its status is right now. I don't know if it.
If you were to say Zorgamazoo is the equivalent to The Hobbit, is Zorgamazoo part two the full trilogy?
The short answer is yes.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's
Jessica, are you excited by that?
I need to read them now. Please, please, Rob, let us have the scoop.
It's weird that I'm on the radio saying this. This book exists. What can I say? It's with my agent now, and I don't know what's going to happen next.
That's all we can say. On that sort of basis.
It is possible I've crossed a line and
it's all right. We won't say anything. Yeah. You know, it's okay. Kaylee, shh.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't hear that.
What were we talking about? I don't even know.
I mean, I've crossed a line. What I mean is I've crossed a line in terms of,
Robert, you did that when
I've
you
done
moved
too
from,
much.
When you, when
I've
when
done
you,
too, like it's so big. It is a really, it's a big, it's a lot of verse. But I'm very pleased with it. I think definitely if you like Zorgamazoo, you will like this book. Like if it was, now Zorgamazoo is not for everyone. I know that some people, they just can't take it. This is too much. What are you doing?
But it's infectious, contagious, and sublime, according to the Globe and Mail.
Yeah, you've got a lot of clippings there, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and it's meant to be read aloud. So,
I think there's another series, an award-winning series coming out here in which, Professor Jason Whittaker investigating podcasts on William Blake. The world needs Robert Paul Weston reading the epic Zorgamazoo.
Absolutely.
There you are. Kaylee, as a second-year student.
There is an audiobook of this, and it was read by Alan Cumming. So... I really don't think I can improve on
Wolverine. Not Wolverine. What am I saying? Nightcrawler. Very confusing there.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Easily confused though. Wolverine, Nightcrawler. I'm sure, John. How often have you been wandering through the streets of Lincoln? And you thought, is that Wolverine? No, it's not Hugh Jackman at all. It's Alan Cumming as Nightcrawler.
Definitely, definitely. I've written about werewolves and stuff. So yeah.
Yeah. Which. Nice little segue there. It moves us back to yourself. Let's talk about one of the other topics we wanted to mention. I mean, if you stay with us, Rob, for that moment. Cromwell. What is it about Oliver Cromwell and the English Civil War as a historian, John, that appeals to your good self? Because we talked about your ghost work in the past, but I wanted to focus on the Cromwell legacy because, let's face it, he wanted to be painted warts and all. He wasn't necessarily the kindest of individuals, and he banned Christmas.
Well, actually, he didn't ban Christmas. That was done before he became Lord Protector. That's one of the myths about him. I first became interested in Cromwell. I was a kid in the 70s, and I saw the film Cromwell with Richard Harris. I don't know if you remember it.
Mm.
And it's not exactly very accurate, but I'd never heard of him. And I thought, this is a fascinating character. So as I got older, I read about him. I had the Lady Bird book of Oliver Cromwell, which I've still got, actually, which is quite good. Some good illustrations in there. And, I mean, he was the first... we became a republic in 1649 after the Civil War, and he was the first commoner to ever become head of state. And I just find him a fascinating character. There's a lot of myths about him, that he was like a stern Puritan who hated pleasure, who banned Christmas, which he... And he loved dancing, he loved hawking, he loved smoking, drinking. He used to have masks at Hampton Court because he was given the Hampton Court as his weekend residence. In fact, Oliver Cromwell invented the British weekend because he needs to take the weekend off as Lord Protector and said, that's it. I'm not back till Monday. I want some time off with my wife. So, but no, it's just a fascinating period. I mean, we had a revolution first before the French, the Americans. And obviously Charles II came back, but we had a constitutional monarchy after that. If Charles I had won, we would have had an absolute monarchy along the lines of the French. And possibly we would have had a revolution the same time as them if Charles had won, you know, because I think eventually people would have got fed up with that. So I'm afraid I'm not a fan of Charles I. I did feel sorry for him when he lost his head at the end, but, you know, it was his own fault, really. But, yeah, so I just find him a really fascinating character. And he's not as bad as people claim he was. I've got to dispel these myths.
Well, okay, John, if you happen to be Irish or have Irish descent in your good self, don't actually go into parts of Ireland and say, Oliver Cromwell, he was my kind of guy. Do you really?
Well, Jason's Irish, so I'm in trouble now, aren't I? Because he'll be on soon. And Jason's a direct descendant of the Earl of Strafford, who was Charles I's chief advisor, who also lost his head because they said, you know, you're giving Charles bad advice, we're going to get rid of you. And apparently, Charles I promised Strafford that he would never. He'd never harm a hair on his head, and he welched on his promise. And apparently, he always regretted that right up to the point that he got executed. But yeah, the Irish question is a very difficult one. I've got to watch what I say here now.
Not just you, but also the current Home Secretary. She has to watch what she's saying as well. And I mean you, Liz Truss. I know I don't get too political at this stage, but, you know, Liz Truss needs to be aware of this.
What she said, I haven't heard about this. I don't follow politics now, so I ain't got a clue what she said. What she said?
Let's not go there. She wants to rip up the protocol and all sorts of other areas there. But
the Irish thing, what it was, the Irish nationalists in the 19th century were looking for an English bogeyman, you know, because they wanted to have a hate figure. And they literally picked Cromwell. I've got to say that a lot of what they claimed he did was exaggerated. He did storm two towns in Ireland, and the inhabitants were put to the sword, all the men in arms.
Again, fairly drastic, really, isn't it? You know, storm the towns, put the inhabitants to the sword. I'd say that's a bit, you know, let's say in, what, 300 or 400 years from now, Vladimir Putin, he was a guy, he was okay, he just stormed Ukraine, what the hey?
Yeah, but what it was, you see, that was the rules of war at the time, and the royalists also did it when they sacked Bolton. Prince Rupert did exactly the same thing. I mean, by our standards, it's wrong. By their standards, it was a rule of war that all the men carrying arms could be put to the sword. Although the stories about women and children being killed were sort of made up and exaggerated, although obviously in any battle, sadly, civilians die. But yeah, he's not popular in Ireland, but there was an Irish historian, Tom Riley, who did a book about Cromwell called Cromwell, an Honourable Enemy. And he actually exposed a lot of these myths as well. And so there's two sides to it. He's you know, it's part of the Irish history that he's a very bad man. But when you actually go back to the source materials, a lot of what they claimed he did, he didn't do. But I'm not going to defend, obviously, putting men to the sword in towns and that. But I mean, they were still doing it apparently in the 19th century in the Peninsula War. It was considered a rule of war, but obviously, you know, we move on, don't we, and things are acceptable.
Well, some countries do. Some countries maintain its business standard operating procedures, you know, standard operating protocols.
War brings out the worst in people, I'm afraid. You know, as Goya, with his famous paintings about war and that, you know, Napoleon in Spain when they committed atrocities. Sadly, you know, it's a shame, that very tragic, that we've got war in Europe again. I honestly never thought that would happen. I mean, I as a sort of generation, unfortunately, never experienced anything like that.
And you know, let's face it, it's only a game between Glasgow Rangers and Eintracht Frankfurt later on today. Honestly, don't get too upset about the whole thing if you are a Scottish football fan.
There you go.
Let's quickly...
Pretty heavy stuff you got me into here. I think Jason's going to kill me afterwards for saying that.
No, well, you know, that would be unfortunate, if not on message, because, you know, putting contributors to the sword is something, as long as the Midweek Drive has air in its lungs, we're not going to do. At least, not as yet.
Good. I'm glad about that.
Robin might disagree.
Moved on, you know, I promise.
Well, okay, let's do a quick sort of round, Robin. Kaylee, in the studio, Oliver Cromwell, any thoughts about him? Great, underrated, fine soul who didn't ban Christmas. That was just a myth put forward by those dreadful Cavaliers.
It's interesting to have to hear somebody that has more expertise than myself. It's interesting to hear myth busted. I don't know. I definitely have more knowledge on him today than I did before. So thank you very much, John.
We like to feel that we can help.
I mean, Christmas was banned. But he didn't actually ban it. It was done before he became Lord Protector. But here again, he didn't rescind
it. If in doubt, take the Boris Johnson line, deny everything. There were no parties here.
He did. It was nothing to do with him. Nothing to do with me, Gov, that's what you said.
Jessica, North Carolina and Oliver Cromwell, any thoughts?
I am so sorry, but I'm not very familiar. I've heard the name, but unfortunately, we do not tend to learn about him in American history.
No, it's exactly.
Or European history class. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But do you know, he was actually, during the American Revolution, he was a hero figure to the Founding Fathers. They actually spoke about him, and medals were struck with his image. So he was sort of like, they almost like a proto-Washington, or, you know, same sort of thing, a general who became leader of a republic. But obviously, we all Washington, he died in his bed and he handed over to someone else. So, in the early American Revolution, he was a bit of a hero figure. But he's not well talked about now in America.
Whether Oliver Cromwell would have actually had much success with ducks, I don't know. Remember, ducks are not little humans in duck outfits. It's the early part of the show.
Some at Hampton Court, I don't know, but I ain't got a clue about Oliver Cromwell and ducks. I know he used to hunt, but hopefully not ducks.
No.
Stay with us, John. We're ready for part three, when hopefully Jason Figgis will be joining us. Robert, Paul, Weston, three for the price of one. Fantastic. Are you going to join us for the next Zoom? Would you like to join us for the next Zoom? It's entirely up to your good self.
I can. I actually had a question about Cromwell.
Well, then go for it. You've got a couple of minutes. Go for it.
Go ahead.
Just because sometimes when I'm teaching, I talk about, it's on the fringes of it's not my specialism, but Charles II, when he came back in, 1660. He comes back in 1660. And I believe he outlawed serious drama. Is that right? There was a period where, like, all British theatre was only allowed to show comedy and melodrama. And
what it was during the 1640s, they banned plays and that because they felt it was immoral. And then Cromwell allowed the first opera to be performed, so he sort of eased the laws. But when Charles II came back. The theatres returned, but it was a lot of comedy and stuff like that, because he famously had an affair with an actress, Nell Gwynn, with her Jaffers.
That's a very dangerous term to actually employ at this particular time of the day, but never mind, it's quite all right.
Sorry, apologies for that. They're oranges. You know,
of course, exactly. It opens up all your... Robert, you may well stick around for the next part. We'll be joined by Jason Figgis, producer and director, and co-director as well. So many wonderful things. Jessica's had to leave us. Robin's back with us as well. Kaylee, we're okay. John, English Civil War, The Clash. Do you feel it's an accurate representation of history?
I do. I mean, it's the long-haired Cavaliers and the short-haired Roundheads is a bit wrong, though, because most of the parliamentarian leaders had long hair, and a lot of them weren't die-hard Puritans. Cromwell wasn't even. But it was basically a clash, Parliament against the King, you know, absolute power, or Parliament having the say. That's to simplify it.
And how that fits in with Joe Strummer can only be decided after the next 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Johnny, come again, home again, hurrah, tra-la,
what's coming by bus or on the ground. We're all too long. A woman dies, shed a tear to see his face so beaten and fair.
Marching Home, the English Civil War as opposed to anything else, with The Clash there. And we've also connected now with the awesomely talented director extraordinaire, who amongst other things in terms of his credits has the delights of The Ecstasy of Abel Man, Children of Darkness, a whole heap of things we say to the fabulous Jason Figgis. How are you, Jason? Welcome to the Midweek Drive.
I'm good, how are you? It's actually The Ecstasy of Isabel Man and Children of a Darker Dawn.
That's exactly what we needed to know. So well corrected, sir. And it's nice to confirm that what John was saying earlier is correct. You are indeed Irish. So we won't talk about Oliver Cromwell, for obvious reasons. Could open up all reasons.
I just identify as being a filmmaker and not necessarily a nationality. Because most of the films I make are either American or British. So.
And these are the critical sort of aspects that are actually there. Robin Pierce is a film buff based in Wales. Robin, any questions you'd like to put to Jason whilst I sort out links for some of our other fine team members?
Yeah, you may not be able to answer this because obviously the answer is, Robin, you are ignorant. But as a longtime horror aficionado, and I've been looking down your credits on the IMDb, how come our paths have never crossed?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, a lot of the stuff I've done are anthology work. You know, where I work with a guy called Tony Newton in the UK, and he's involved with a lot of the major horror distributors around the world. And he would literally come to me and say, Jay, we're working on this zombie anthology. Will you shoot a piece for me? And I'll go, yeah, I've got to spare a few hours. I'll shoot a piece for you. And it ends up, you know, I get a notification a month later going, Wild Eye Releasing or Sector 5 or Worldwide Multimedia are releasing it on DVD and video on demand. So it's kind of almost like this passive form of filmmaking, you know, where I do something very quickly and send it to him and he go, love it, it's in the anthology. But the other films, funnily enough, Children of a Darker Dawn and The Ecstasy of Isabel Mann, they started off as summer projects because I teach drama to children. So we literally said, okay, we're going to have this thing called Feature Film Project Ireland, Team Feature Film Project Ireland. We just got kids to join up. And then I created roles for them. And so, you know, one girl maybe was suited to playing this particular role and a little boy suited to that role. And I would create roles with them around who they were as people. But the films were never meant to be released. That was the funny thing. They were literally just summer projects for the kids. And then my agent, a guy called Doug Zwick, had popped to his studios in Los Angeles. He said, "Oh, send them over to me anyway and have a look." And he goes, "Oh, man, I really like these." And he said, "Leave them with me." And before I knew it, MVD Entertainment Group had signed them up and given them worldwide releases. And I was like, that was never meant to happen, you know? So, hello, John West. I didn't realize they were going to go out to the world. And I thought, well, they were never really meant to be seen by the general public. But I'm so glad that I did, because I ended up then attracting the attention of a lot of really interesting reviewers and magazines like Starburst and other filmmakers from around the world who wanted to collaborate with me. So I kind of thought what started off with just fun summer projects with kids turned out to be like, you know, a gateway drug, you know, to meeting all these like-minded people and stuff going from, you know, from that level to getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know. So I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a great way to go, you know, a great route to take.
What inspired you to take the horror route?
Well, I think like John and I kind of grew up, you know, with parents who would allow us stay up at night and watch, especially the weekend of horrors on BBC Two. And that was really inspiring, you know, kind of watching. They had a black and white, and then they had a Hammer or an Amicus or a Tyburn or something, you know, so you were always
remembered and loved and missed.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and the fact that in Ireland as well, a lot of people don't realize that we had the best of the British channel. So we never watched our own channel. It was like, you see, in Ireland, nobody would even blink. I don't think I can say anything without expletives, but I'll find that. I've forgotten where I am. Oh yeah, we were talking about BBC horror movies and that. And so when we were kids, you know, we flicked on BBC One or BBC Two, and that was us growing up, you know, with the two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise and Kenny Everett, and then the, you know, the M.R. James Ghost Stories for Christmas, where we would literally buy the Radio Times and we'd feverishly go through it to see if they had a ghost story for Christmas that year. And it was like, oh my God, they do. And the entire Christmas was built around sitting there watching this terrifying ghost story, which I would sit with a pillow up beside the fire, you know, kind of watching them. And in fact, when I saw The Signal Man, I couldn't look at a dead woman with her eyes open for years after that. Not I don't mean like in real life, you know, I just mean in movies.
I was going to ask, how many do you come across during a day?
But to me, that was the most terrifying thing, when they carried that bride off the train, or they lifted her off the track and she was upside down with her eyes open. It literally haunted me for months. So there were certain kind of visual motifs that really stayed in my mind. And I thought they're very effective. Like, you don't need blood and guts. You need atmosphere. You need setting a scene. You know, that's the kind of stuff you want to aim for, you know, gently kind of tease out an idea and then allow the audience take that idea and run with it and use their imagination to kind of to create the horrors in their own mind. So stuff like that really appealed to me growing up, you know, that I've never been a fan of gross out horror. Although, funnily enough, when I did Children of a Darker Dawn and The Ecstasy of Isabel Mann, we've got some really nasty violence in both of them, but it was the kids egging it on. They were like, want more blood, we want to gouge his eyes out, we want to eviscerate him. This is like 9, 10-year-old girls, 12-year-old girls. I'm going, you know, back off, kids, back off. But they were so bloodthirsty, you know. So when we had the premiere of Children of a Darker Dawn, and all the parents and the children came to see the movie, I had to stand up and give a warning. And I said, now, I know this was a summer project, people, but this is really violent. And you've got to, they were leaving in droves. By the beginning of the second act, people were carrying little children out. An old woman tumbled down the steps of the cinema, right? And I had to, she was 90 years old, and I had to go out after her. And my producer was laughing. And I said, shut up, she could be seriously injured. And I ran after her and I said, are you okay? And she goes, yes, I've just never heard my little 13-year-old granddaughter use such foul language.
Hence the apology we had to use earlier. You know, it's very important.
Yes. They taught me that language, so I apologize. 13-year-old girl.
The sensitivity of the midweek drive-outs cannot be overestimated. Gaily, you've been listening to...
Because it's so inherent, I don't even know what I'm saying.
We do, Jason. That's why we keep an eye on the button. But Jason, Kaylee, any questions that you'd like to put to Jason?
Yeah, I have one. I'm not sure how, not mean, but so I know that it's very typical to ask you your favourite, but do you have a least favourite out of your babies, so to speak?
Oh, my films. Well, with me, it's a case of, I started off making documentaries, so I love The Twilight Hour, which was the film that kind of got me going.
Yeah,
there was Discovery and everything, so it was really good. Mm-hmm. Then I went on to do Maverick in London, which I loved also, because that was Sky Arts.
Yeah.
It was a really, you know, you're walking down the street arm in arm with Joanna Lumley and stuff, so mm-hmm. it's kind of like, yes. So I loved those two films.
Yeah.
But then when I started moving into drama, and because I was teaching and I was working with what I would say not the ideal cast, as in I wasn't handpicking them.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain movies of mine that I just never watch again. Like
the first
film I made, Three Crosses, I never watch it. Mm-hmm. I don't watch Children of a Darker Dawn or The Exe of Isabel Mann because mm-hmm. they were exercises in creating something with kids, which was amazing at the time.
Yeah.
But I couldn't sit with an audience mm-hmm. and watch and not be criticizing every single aspect of it, because you'll have one child who's an amazing actor and then you'll have another one opposite who's not so amazing. That's me being nice. And you're kind of like, you can't cut that. You mm-hmm. can't cut that together. It doesn't work. But as you know, with film, it's only as good as its weakest link.
Yeah, yeah.
If you've got anyone giving a bad performance, the whole movie's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. It's like Keanu Reeves. I love him. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, so... he's great as John Wick, and he's great when he gets fat and grows a beard. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a very weird thing that
and,
I think because he's so handsome, right?
Yeah.
I think he gets self-conscious when he looks great and he can't give as good a performance. And then when he gets heavy and he has a big beard, he suddenly finds his acting chops.
Yeah.
You know? John's there going, oh my God, Jason, you're destroying.
But surely, Jason, I mean, you know, Wild Stallions, three Bill and Ted adventures, and of course, four Matrix movies. You can't argue with that, surely. Anyway.
No, I can't. I love him. I love Keanu Reeves. I think he's marvelous.
I think that's placated the waters. That's nicely done.
Yeah.
Traditional Irish balm. That's poured oil over troubled water. Sure enough.
Absolutely.
The thing is, I'm much worse with my own work. You know, I literally eviscerate my own work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like people are kind of going, seriously, it's not that bad. You know, I mean, don't be so vicious with yourself. But I figure you have to be, because if you're not, you're never going to improve. You're never going to.
Yeah.
I try and. Whatever I do, I try and make it better than the last thing I've done.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only way you can improve as a filmmaker, where you're honest with yourself. I'm a collaborator. John would tell you that. I love to collaborate on stuff. I'm not an autocrat. I don't kind of go, no, I've said it's perfect and that's the way it's going to be. I love listening to people around me going, hey, what if we did this or what if we tried that? To me, that's really important.
Yeah, I think ultimately...
And that's what I did with the kids, you know, making the movie. It was like, we'd like to... We want to eviscerate that guy. Okay, let's do that. Have we got the effects for that? Okay, let's give it a go. You know, so long as it's relatively within the narrative. But if you're making a summer project movie with kids, it's very hard to have a very clear narrative. You know, you're really you're going into post-production and you're piecing together a narrative and trying to make it work fully.
Yeah, I think
but
like,
I'm still
like you
I
said.
Know that them in years and kind of go, oh my God, they like it because they age. You know the way films age?
Yeah.
And because they age, they take on a charm
mm-hmm.
that maybe you feel at the time.
Yeah.
You know? So Children of a Darker Dawn was 11 years ago
and
actually Isabel Mann was 10 years ago. The kids contact me when I put up a poster because Isabel Mann is now on Fox's Tubi, you know?
Yeah.
And so they're all like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm 25 now. You know? And you're like,
at the moment, Jason, stay with us for the present time. I want to actually turn back to our ace author, Robert Paul Weston, and I'm just sort of citing one of Robert's blog entries, which always impressed me. And it was one of the reasons why, when we first encountered each other, we were both wearing masks, so obviously it was socially distanced. He says, joining the University of Lincoln, it's not just the name of a dead American president. For nearly 1,000 years before his assassination, Lincoln referred to a small cathedral city in the East Midlands. Why am I writing this? Because I'm very pleased to announce that from October, I'll be joining the English and Journalism Department at the University of Lincoln as its newest lecturer in creative writing. That moved me, Rob, and I never had a chance to actually say how moved I was by that. And literally, within 6 months, the school has actually disseminated into its own way. So it just proves that the quality of that sort of essence was there.
Yeah, or it proves that I have an acidic effect on university programs.
How often do people
add me and the whole thing dissolves?
Yeah. I mean, how often do people, maybe even in Ireland, Jason, think Lincoln is that a dead American president? Well, yes, it is, but it's also university as well. There we are. That's part and parcel. Rob, have you got any questions you'd like to put to Jason about his life and times over in the land of emeralds, joy, and leprechauns?
Okay. God. Yes. I don't know. Jason, you can take that. That was Alex talking. That was not me. I didn't.
I know.
I'm not going to associate.
Listen, at least they're not swearing leprechauns. That's the important thing.
So hi, Jason. I don't think we've met unless we
How
have.
Are you?
I don't. Hi. I have a question because I see that you've moved from documentary to horror. In a sense, horror, the supernatural, basically, in some ways, the opposite of documentary. If documentary is fact and truth and the world out there, horror is the opposite. The two are diametrically opposed. Mix them together, you get not but pure energy. So
yeah.
I'm curious about this. Do you, as a director of both, do you see any connection between these two? And just discuss.
No, I don't. I don't actually see a connection.
Hey, great. Job done.
Exactly. Genius. Yeah. Cutting to the quick.
Yeah, I fell into making horror movies because of my love of them growing up. But I kind of, because I moved from documentary filmmaking into making a film called Three Crosses, which was an utterly insane endeavor. I knew nothing about making drama, and I ended up shooting 140 hours of footage, and it just made no sense. But I ended up making something that kind of made sense, and that also got released on DVD and video on demand. So I was kind of pleased about a film that made no sense at all. I still managed to put a stamp on it so that somebody was going to go, do you know what? We like this and we're going to take a punt on it and we're going to put it out to the world. So I went from that to teaching and I thought, you know, I really want to work with kids. I know what a good performance is and I want to work with kids and try and get them to a point where they feel they could perform. So it ended up being horror and because kids liked horror. And I thought, okay, we'll do that. We'll work on horror. And then because I had made these two horror films, other people were coming to me and going, hey, do you want to do this movie or this horror movie? And I got kind of stuck in a horror rut, whereas it's not something that's really appealed to me. And you'll find out that a lot of directors end up starting off making horror, whereas I started off making documentaries that were getting really good reviews and you know, getting national, international platforms. I went into this through teaching and then decided, you know what? I really don't want to do this anymore. I made a couple of really violent horror movies that even, our national, we have a thing here called Film Ireland. They actually put out a warning on one of them and they said, it's our moral obligation to warn you about this film, that if you're going to watch it, you're going to be scarred by it. And I thought, that actually isn't me. It's not me. I don't want to be known for making movies that scar people because they're not the kind of movies I like to look. I mean, my favorite movie of all time is Lionel Jeffery's The Railway Children, you know?
Nice.
So that gives you
pretty
more
horrific,
idea.
Though. Pretty horrific, Jason.
Okay, you know, I write children's books. So right. It's kind of that's in my wheelhouse. Great book and film.
I still cry watching Jenny Agutter go, Daddy, my daddy. And I think especially now because I'm a dad and I have a 5-year-old daughter. The funny thing is, right, when my wife got pregnant, am I allowed to say pregnant?
Yes. Yes, that is acceptable, Jason. Worry not.
Okay. When my wife got pregnant, I completely changed. I thought, I'm not doing horror anymore. I don't want to make stuff that my daughter is going to be going, why can't I watch daddy's movie about a murdered girl called Torment? Or why can't I watch his really vicious, nasty revenge thriller, Don't You Recognize Me? Which it did great, and Starburst maybe director of the month, Starburst magazine, after seeing that, and that's all great, but they're not films that I'd want my daughter kind of hunting out going, daddy, can I watch this? Because they're brutal, you know? And so I decided, you know what, I want to get back to doing what I love, and that is documentary. So that's how John West and I met, because I decided, my great friend Simon Marsden passed away in 2012 on John Hurt's birthday, which was strange because John Hurt, we had worked with him on The Twilight Era. And then I approached his wife, Lady Caroline Marsden, and I said, would you be interested in me making a film about his life and work? And of course, he was a Lincoln man, you know? She said, actually, I wouldn't want anyone else to do it, which was very heartwarming, you know? And she invited me to their house, and I stayed there, and we started filming. And then I gathered all the footage I needed, but then I ended up in East Anglia. I was hired to direct a documentary about M.R. James. So as we'd been talking, Robin, earlier about the watching those, you know, the M.R. James ghost stories for Christmas. And that's how I ended up meeting John, because he heard that I was in East Anglia and he wanted to interview me for Psychic News. And I was like, oh God, I can't be dealing with any of that at the moment. But when I got home, I was in my parents' back garden on a sunny day, and I rang him, and he said, oh great, let's have a chat. We discovered we had a huge amount in common, and he wanted to promote the Simon Marsden film after seeing A Rough Cut. And he was so bloody good at it that we kind of went, you know what, he was kind of like the person I've been looking for. I'd worked with a lot of producers who were really more like glorified location managers. I had done all the work myself, but they were taking producer credits, and it started to annoy me. And now I meet a guy who is like, I call him the British, even though he's a gentleman, I call him the British Bulldog, because he will not take no for an answer. He will knock and knock and knock until somebody answers the door.
Tenacious. The times he was actually just hammering on the Siren Studios doors, saying, let me on the midweek drive. It's very important.
Yeah. It's great. He would tell me, I'm determined to get on Siren again.
Yeah.
But So he started running with it, and he got a load of magazines, you know, glossy magazines and newspapers going. And then we met for the first time in London at the BFI, because Nikon ended up sponsoring the final cut of the film, and it was screened at the BFI. We had a big screening there. Hayley Mills came, which, you know, she's one of my heroines, and I got a hug and a kiss from Hayley Mills.
A hug and a kiss from Pollyanna. Now, Pollyanna would never have been uttering F words.
More importantly, you know, Whistle Down the Wind, one of the great, great British films, one of the great films of all time. And we decided to have lunch, and we had lunch in the London Museum. And he said to me, you know, why don't we do so? I said, yes, let's start a company together. We called it Figgis West. He was saying, why not West Figgis? But people would be looking for it.
No, alphabetically, John, alphabetically. F comes before W, you know?
So I said, so we started off, and he said, well, what would you like to do first? And I said, well, I wrote this movie called Winifred Meeks, and I've been trying to get Lara Belmont from Tim Roth's War Zone to star in it, because it's a one-woman show, and you need a really, really good actress to carry an entire movie on her shoulders. And he said, when do you want to do it? And I said, October. And it was like 2 or 3 months away. And he's like, all right, leave it to me. And he ended up finding the house and getting everything sorted. And I just had to turn up. I turned up on location, Laura there, the whole crew there, and we made our movie in 8 days. And then it got picked up by Bayview in the US. And then John said, you know what, I'm tired of waiting for British distribution. And John rings up, I think maybe the second company, which was the brilliant High Flyers at a Pinewood studio. And they go, we love it, we'll distribute it. So, you know, if it wasn't for John, I'd still be like trying to find the right people to work with. But John kind of engenders this, you know, we could do this next.
It's the can-do attitude that's often been put forward as...
So we always write the same subject, so we'd immediately kind of... we'd go, yeah, that's the one. And we'd then jump into it with the same level of enthusiasm, which means, you know, the universe works in your favour when you do that. Exactly. And, you know, stuff gets done.
John T. West, the T
nice
stands
catch.
For
nice
tenacious.
Catch, Jason. That was good.
Tenaciousness, great stuff there. Okay, Kaylee, back to yourself. Any questions for either John or indeed Jason that you'd like to bowl across the airwaves?
Ooh,
or not, as the case may be. We've got lots more that we can actually work through. I mean, Robin, you've obviously shared the pages of Starburst with Jason. Somehow I feel that there are other movies that Jason's been involved with that certainly will be on your list of things to connect.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've got a note here. As you may know, I do kind of a review of the show in the last quarter. Mm. And here we have Jason Figgis making horror films with children, and a note by it saying, check out some of his work where you can.
Yeah.
So I will definitely be checking some of your stuff out, because I am intrigued.
I'll send you links. I'll send you private links.
Yeah, if you would, please, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
It goes a long way from our original sort of feature on puppy training, but still, that's another line entirely. John, what's next up for the West Figgis partnership? See what I did there, West Figgis. Oh, just testing it out there. Loads, testing it out.
Figgis, yeah. West is better. That sounds better. well, we've got a Colin Wilson.
Actually, West Figgis sounds like a place in Scotland, doesn't it?
It does.
That's why we never used it, because it'll be looking for it in Scotland. Where's West Figgis? I don't know where this is. But now we've got a documentary series on Colin Wilson, the writer and philosopher, who was from Leicester. We've got some film projects, other documentaries. One's called Lavender Fields, Bure's Dragon, which is a romantic drama. That's going to be with Diane Keane, if you remember her. She's did loads of stuff in
Cuckoo
the 70s
Waltz.
And 80s.
Cuckoo Waltz is just one of the Cuckoo series Waltz. She did.
Yeah, and Jason's always coming up with ideas for films. You've got a romantic drama that's going to be filmed in New York, and there's a film that Jason's doing as director, Cold Sun. That's not a Figgis West production, but I'm going to be sort of PA on that, and that's going to be filmed this year. And we just got tons of stuff.
Francois Pascal. That's it. Remember Francois Pascal? Who starred in Mind Your Language and many movies. She was the girl in Peter Sellers' Soup, in that movie, The Girl in My Soup.
Which at least wasn't as politically incorrect as Mind Your Language would now be considered these days, but that's a different line entirely.
Yeah, can I just ask at this point, the documentary about Colin Wilson, is that the Colin Wilson who wrote Space Vampires, filmed as Life Force?
Oh, yes, right. Yes.
There is only one, Robin. It's important. On the other hand, if...
common enough name...
If Jason's actually interested, I'm sure that there could well be a bidding war for Natsumi's Song of Summer, written by Robert Paul Weston. Do you think that could have cinematic potential, Robert, in terms of a pair of cousins separated by language, continent and culture, meeting for the first time when Jill travels to Japan to visit her far-flung cousin?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes, please. I mean, that's what every writer says when someone says, "Do you think they can make a movie of this book?" Maybe that's it. Is where is that book? Let's see. I can show you a little.
Yeah. See, if he'd come down to the studio and taken those steps, you see, he would have been able to actually hold the book out there. But at least he'd see it on Zoom. The listener is actually going to obviously see it being there. There we are.
No one can see that. We're on radio.
No, the rest of the team can see it. That's the important thing. The listener, just use your imagination.
I've written two. These are two my most recent work. They're picture books, and they're both sort of international books set with some kind of cultural exchange between Japan and the English-speaking world somewhere. Natsumi Song of Summer is a couple of cousins who've never met, one of them going to Japan for the summer to visit her cousin for the first time and kind of learning about Japan and then finding out. One of the things about that's funny about that I noticed that when I was in Japan was there's no fear of insects in a way that I'm used to seeing, especially amongst children. Mm. That children are introduced. When you go to the pet shop, there'll be puppies, kittens, and then gigantic stag beetles right beside each other. And you'll see the same crowd that's going, oh, these kittens are so cute. They'll be saying that about beetles and insects.
If it's irradiated by atomic radiation, will it grow to a gigantic size, they'll be saying? You know, these are the ways forward, I suppose.
Yeah. No, not so much. Well, So I really like this idea that the way you're introduced to something really affects, and it can affect you for life, that if the first time you see an insect is when someone chases you around the playground going, ooh, look, it's a spider, that will be spiders for you for the rest of your life. And in Japan, if someone says, oh, look how cute this cicada is, let's go get the cicadas out of the trees and have them crawl on us, and look how cool they are and interesting. No one develops that. No one really has that.
It's the sort of movie which, when you make Natsumi's Song of Saba, Jason, you could proudly show it to your child and she'll say, Daddy, I'm so impressed with that. I'm just saying.
Well, I'm going to get all your books now from my daughter. That's going to be next mission. Because I know she loves them. Even looking at the cover of that book, I know immediately she'd be all over that. She'd love it. So yeah, I'm definitely going to get those.
And,
yeah,
and once again, the Midweek Drive mission is accomplished by putting creatives together across the universe.
How wholesome, I know.
Well, I like to think
It is a mutual feeling, because Jason, I was not aware of your work, so now I will be seeking out. I will have, you know, I've got added to my film list. I am interested. I mean, M.R. James. I mean, that is great.
And sort of John Hurt, of course,
kind of
awarded
Lovecraft kind of ghost stories and things. Yeah,
John Hurt awarded a professorship, an honorary professorship, by the University of Lincoln back in the day when he was still alive. Obviously, it's important to actually.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I feel I'm in august company.
Well, so. You're on the Midweek Drive. It's what happens. Okay, let's bowl the questions out. I'll go to Jason first. Jason, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you, apart from obviously the F word, which we've already apologized for? And besides, that's the producer's fault. We should have warned you straight off. Don't swear, please.
Yes, well, I take no responsibility for the bad language whatsoever, because it's cultural, okay? So I've had a great time, actually, very relaxing. It's easily the most enjoyable interview I've done in quite a while.
Oh, wow.
So very good.
Well, the next question is, will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back someday and join us once again in the Midweek Drive in the magic of Zoomland?
I would love to.
Round of applause for Jason Vegas, please. That's very good. And John West, has it been good for you, John? Have you enjoyed the spread that we went from obviously finding out about Zorgamazoo right the way through to the whole wonderment of Oliver Cromwell, and of course the rationale for going Figgis West as opposed to West Figgis?
It's been wonderful as always, and I want to come back too.
This is good. Robert, you're so far away, so many yards away from the actual studio. Has it been okay for you?
Yes, as ever. This is my second or third time. I can't remember.
It's the third, actually. All three on Zoom.
It's always a pleasure. And I know your follow-up question is, will I be back? And yes, indeed, I will.
In the studio next time, maybe.
Oh, you don't want to push it, Kaylee.
I will give it a shot.
He'll
pass us by if he leaves in the next 20 minutes or so.
It's pretty good down here. It is.
I mean, Kaylee, you just had one class with me teaching C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And
here
you are.
And here we are.
Exactly.
Yeah, what more do you need, Rob? It's great down here.
I pass you all the, like, on my way out. I've seen you in the booth.
You pass, you don't say anything, you ignore me, you cut me dead. It's all right.
Hello.
Next time I see you, please say hi if you see me.
Of course,
100%.
Very, very good.
This is a weird way to meet this way.
It's been great.
All right, enough already. We don't get into a self congratulatory thing. Jason Figgis, John West, and Robert Paul West, we salute you. Take care. Robin's coming up for part four to find out who is going to be the Robin Pierce most valuable contributor on the program today.
Just hollow grounds. Look, your love has drawn red from World's longest-running magazine of sci-fi, horror and fantasy. Host of Piercing the Veil, regular Stone Tapes and Midweek Drive contributor, and the UK's very own Welsh Caped Crusader. Tis time for Robin Pierce.
The special Robin Pierce remix there of Twisted My Sobriety by Tanita Tikaram. And guess what? He's back again. How are you, Robin Pierce?
I haven't heard that intro for such a long time.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
The Stone Tapes.
Yeah.
That was, what, about 2-3 years ago now?
3 years ago, wow. Apart from a Christmas special, which was astoundingly wonderful, if only for the ego that was actually dealt with, which is fantastic. So, onwards, Robin, please.
Right. Well, you know what? What a show. It's getting harder and harder to try and review these shows because they cover such a wide breadth of topics. I mean, this time, for example, the surreal aspect of the show started in the early moments with talk of puppet penguins. Hmm. And I thought, right, this is as off the wall as we can possibly get this week. But I was wrong.
Hmm.
Because we then went on to dog behaviour, we went on to children's literature written in rhyme, we went on to Oliver Cromwell, we went on to horror movies starring kids. I mean, what a diverse range of stuff we handled this week. The puppy behavioural issues pre-record with Zigzag I found particularly interesting because I'm no dog expert. I have a dog with me right now. But I'm no expert. But the things that I have learned over the years are get to know your pet. Get to know their idiosyncrasies, their little quirks. They're not humans. In fact, we heard maybe the quote of the entire show, dogs are not humans in fur coats. Okay. It has actually been corrupted a bit since then because we've heard such gems as goldfish are not little humans in swimsuits. Mm. And we've also heard that ducks aren't little humans in feathers. But, you know, okay. Some sage advice given, you know, learning to communicate with your dogs. And it just angers me. It really angers me that people give up puppies after 6 months. And in some cases, after 12 weeks, if they don't practically immediately take to house training. I mean, you have to raise a dog like you would raise a child. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't throw your kids out, don't throw your puppy out. It is literally because it doesn't know any better and it's up to you to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Then we had Rob Weston, who was only one floor above you. He writes children's literature, particularly Zorga Mazoo, which is written in verse. And I asked him at the time, and my question still stands, that sounds such an unique fantasy and written in verse. What a labour of love. And, you know, why didn't he get all the plaudits
that J.K. Rowling got, because his sounds so much more entertaining. Maybe it's a matter of taste. I don't know. And of course, John West, Ghost Hunter, talking about Oliver Cromwell and how he didn't actually ban Christmas after all. But then again, our current governments did. Wonder how they're going to be seen in history. Not well, I think. Jason Figgis, the amazing creator who makes horror movies with kids and has them released, and in some cases, really gory ones. He gave a frank and open interview, and I really enjoyed talking to him. I could have spoken to him for the complete two-hour run of the show. But then again, your finger would have been over the mute button practically constantly. And his enthusiasm was so infectious that I might have lapsed into using colourful language.
No!
Hey, this is Wales, we swear. Now, no doubt you want to know who the MVC, the most valuable contributor, was. And it was a tough decision. But in the song break, I made my final decision. And it's not going to go where you might think it was going
to
go.
I mean, not to John Bill's iconic military models.
Not this time.
Yeah, wow. Maybe next time, yeah.
Not this time. Shall we have the announcement?
Yes, please.
And I will tell you the reasoning as well, okay, after I've named the person. So, at this moment, on the radio, Kaylee, can you take a bow, please?
Me?
You are the most valuable contributor.
No way.
No way.
Oh wow. Thank you very much, Robin. What an honor.
You want to know why?
Yeah, I would actually. I'm very curious. That's the last thing I expected you to say.
Okay. When we were talking to Jason Figgis, Alex turned the questioning to you.
Yeah.
And your first instinct was to ask him not what his favourite horror movie that he had made was, but what was the least favourite. And I thought, she is a genius. She's thinking on her feet. Now, I've done magazine interviews, I've done on-stage interviews and conventions, and I like to throw in a question. I mean, you ask your open questions, like, oh, what's your favourite? What inspires you? And, you know, sort of all this.
Yeah.
But I do like to slip in what I call the sucker punch.
Yeah.
It's the one thing that they never see coming. And you did that beautifully.
Oh, thank you very much.
And absolute kudos.
Thank you.
To you for that. Because if that's the way that your mind works, you have definitely going to have a great future doing this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
And I'm hoping that you get at it.
I'm genuinely flattered. Thank you so much.
Well, it's only your second show.
Yeah, yeah.
I never thought I'd be saying this. But absolutely, it is well deserved.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Trust me, there's
he doesn't
stuff
give
that
these platitudes
the
like
rear end of a bull. That stuff that comes out of a rear end of a bull. I don't do that.
Exactly.
I tell it like it is.
Exactly. It's wonderful stuff and richly deserved. So, thanks to Jessica Burtis, William Coles, and Robert Paul Weston, of course, John West and Jason Figgis, Lorna Winter and Carolyn Menteith, and, of course, Kaylee Mansell. Robin, has it been a good show for you?
Oh, it's been amazing. Yeah, what a fast-moving 2 hours, huh?
He wasn't lying,
very.
You see. This is it. Will you be back again in around about a week's time?
Oh, you know it.
Excellent. And just in case you're wondering what was happening on Saturday night in a part of Europe celebrating the Ukraine, that's what we're wrapping up with. Up next, we have the early night show with Callum and friends. Callum and Reese, to be precise. That's Reese and Callum.
Nice.
Might argue. Might have gone alphabetically. keep on keeping on, Kaylee. We'll see you again soon, no doubt.
Yes, definitely. I hope so.
Did you watch Eurovision, by the way, Robin? Silly question. Silly question. Did you, Kaylee? Did you?
No. No. I kind of tuned in and out, and I was absolutely flabbergasted at
Spaceman,
her performance.
Sam Ryder.
Incredible.
The power of TikTok.
Truly, wow, yeah.
Tempted to give an option. Do you want to go with Sam Ryder and Spaceman or Kalish with Stefania, the Kalish Orchestra? Mm. In the end, we'll stick with the Ukraine. Yeah. After all, they have to do with Oliver Cromwell fans these days. And who knows what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Is it Cromwell in charge of the Kremlin? Could be. Cromwell at the Kremlin. Maybe it's maybe it's for future historians to decide that.
One thing, Alex. I mean, speaking of the Ukraine, right? For next week's show, can I request that at some point we hear Ukrainian Cowboy?
Nice choice. Unlikely to be played, but we'll wait and see.
Stefania, mamo, mamo, Stefania, розквітає поле, а вона сивіє. Заспівай мені, мамо, колискову, хочу ще почути твоє рідне слово.
Вона мене колесала, дала мені ритм, і напевне сило болі не забрати мене, бо дала вона, напевне знала, може більше і від сола. Вона ломаними дорогами прийду, я завжди до тебе, вона не розбудить, не будить. Мене в сині бурі забере бабулі, звідтулі, ніби вони кулі. Дуже добре знала мене, не була обманута, як було дуже втомлена, гойдала мене в так.
Radio 107.3.